Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered. Like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right. Because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at carvana.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another HBB episode on Behind the Knife. This is your HBB team from the MD Anderson Cancer Center. My name is Anish, a T32 research fellow here at MD Anderson. I'm excited to be joined by some great mentors of mine and Dr. Tim Newlook, the associate PD of the HBB Fellowship here at MD Anderson, and the legend himself, Dr. Jean-Nicolas Vautet, the chief of our HBB section. Today, we're going to discuss some advances in preoperative venous deprivation that build upon portal venous embolization, known as PVE. Specifically, we'll discuss hepatic venous embolization, simultaneous portal hepatic venous embolization, and a fast-track two-stage hepatectomy. It sounds like a lot, but we'll do our best to break it down. With that being said, Dr. Vautet, could you give us a brief overview of PVE for context before we get into our discussion?
Thank you, Dr. Jane. We are very happy to discuss PVE today, and it's a procedure we have great experience with at MD Anderson for now more than 2 decades. We started PVE more than 20 years ago in the U.S., based on the work of Professor Makuchi in Japan, who noted that when it was one-sided, portal vein occlusion was leading to contralateral hypertrophy of the liver. The liver regenerates, and this is due to the presence of hepatocyte growth factor and the co-mitogenic factors such as insulin and glucagon. So when we do PVE, we do this in interventional radiology primarily, and we induce the regeneration of the contralateral liver. This is mostly done when you have a small left liver. The liver is unequal in terms of volumetry. The left liver on average is 33% of the total liver volume, so that's why we perform right portal vein embolization. Sometimes we perform right portal vein embolization with extension to segment 4 when we want to do an extended right hepatectomy. These procedures done in interventional radiology are very well tolerated by the patient. They are performed as outpatient, and the patient leaves the same day and stays one day locally, and then the liver resection can be performed about 3 weeks later. Of course, we do CT scans to guide this portal vein embolization, and we look at the volumetry, the size of the future liver remnant, the liver that will remain after the liver resection. So it's an anticipated liver, future liver remnant, and we target some volumes. When the liver is small, it's 20% or less than 20%, 30% less than 30%, or 40% less than 40%, we consider portal vein embolization. And these numbers are derived from our experience with the outcome of liver resection. In patients with a normal liver, we would like to at least have 20% liver remnant. In patients who have received chemotherapy, we want at least 30%. Patients with cirrhosis or fibrosis would like 40% liver remnant. So we target our volume-free liver resection, and we performed the portal vein embolization, measured the liver volume before portal vein embolization with the CT, and we repeat the CT before the liver resection. And if the anticipated liver volume is what you like to have, then we go ahead and perform the liver resection. And the liver resection, in fact, has become very safe with very low risk of hepatic insufficiency or liver failure when the volume, the adequate volume is reached for the anticipated liver resection.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Botain. I think that's a great, great summary. And it's important to remember, though, that as Dr. Botain said, while a lot of patients will have adequate hypertrophy after PVE, some case series have reported that up to 15% don't achieve a sufficient future liver remnant, as Dr. Botain mentioned. And that's why many groups, including ours, have investigated ways to induce further hypertrophy in these patients, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. And so one of the new methods to address insufficient future liver hypertrophy following PVE is the utilization of adjunctive hepatic vein embolization, or HVE, after PVE. And in 2020, our group published an article detailing the use of HVE in patients who had inadequate FLR hypertrophy after PVE. And so just a brief overview, it was a retrospective review of 9 patients with colorectal liver metastasis who received neoadjuvant chemotherapy and underwent PVE, but still had an insufficient FLR afterward. And they underwent either hepatic venous embolization of either the right or middle hepatic veins in an attempt to induce further hypertrophy. Of the 9 patients, only 3 underwent definitive liver surgery. And in these 3 patients, there was no evidence of any postoperative hepatic insufficiency as defined by total bilirubin greater than 7 in the postoperative period. And there were no perioperative mortalities attributable to liver insufficiency, which was once the predominant cause of death in patients undergoing liver resection. And as expected, we had statistically significant increases in future liver remnant following PVE. However, we also found statistically significant increases in FLR after hepatic venous embolization, and there were no complications from the procedure either. So, Dr. Newlick, what are some of the big takeaway points that our listeners should understand from this article?
Well, thank you, Dr. Jane. I'd like to say first that as a younger, newer surgeon here, I've been fortunate enough to base my practice truly standing on the shoulders of giants. And it's important to know the history of how we've got to this point. With our refined selection for surgery based on these hypertrophy indices, we're able to offer very safe surgery. And Dr. Botain discussed the portal vein embolization. And the key here is that there's a measurement of both adequate volume that we need to get to, but also the rate of growth after these procedures. And if you feel like your patient is somebody who just needs a little bit more, maybe the rate of growth, the kinetic growth rate, so to speak, was adequate in your mind, but the volume that you, as Dr. Vote mentioned, have in your mind you want to get to before offering surgery is just in we're now almost at the finish line. There's always the question of what else can we do to help induce more hypertrophy to get to the operating room. You may get to an adequate volume, but the rate of growth, the KGR, so to speak, after PVE is clearly insufficient. That's a patient who's still at risk for surgery because of a failed stress test, so to speak. So if you want to get somebody to the operating room just by a volume index alone, the question is, what can you do next? And that naturally that the mind may wander when you think about the volume, the anatomy of a liver, as to what else you can do interventionally to get that adequate growth. And I think the very first thing that someone may think of is, well, why can't you embolize the other veins that are in the liver, the hepatic veins? And there's multiple groups around the world who have published early experiences on that. Our early experience, as Dr. Jane mentioned, was in a paper in 2020 with Dr. Vote and partners in our interventional radiology group, including Dr. Wong, Mavash, Adisio, and RR. And this is a very early experience of a sequential intervention where patients who didn't meet the finish line, as I spoke about with portal vein embolization, they moved on to hepatic vein embolization. The key here is that it's safe. patients were able to tolerate the additional embolization procedure. So I think this paper established it as a salvage technique to induce more growth if PVE didn't make it. I think just bringing it back to the very beginning, the key here is if the liver didn't grow because of poor liver quality, I think that's a patient who should not be selected for hepatic vein embolization. And the liver told you already that it's somebody who's probably not on the path to surgery. So the higher level commentary here for me is that this is an additional salvage technique for someone who you do think has a decent chance to grow even further if the target is surgery for an individual patient.
I think it's a good summary of this paper. This paper, again, was our preliminary experience. We have now more experience with combined hepatic vein and portal vein embolization in the same setting. And this is something we are particularly interested in patients with very small future liver remnant volume on the CT. They present up front with a very, very small liver, and our experience with portal vein embolization in these patients indicates that portal vein embolization is not sufficient to induce regeneration that's adequate for safe liver surgery. So clearly, these hepatic vein embolization are novel approach, and in fact, a better approach than other more aggressive approaches to regenerate the liver before major resection, such as the ALPS procedure, associated portal vein ligation and transection of liver before major liver resection. The ALPS procedure has been performed at many centers where there were limited resources in terms of interventional radiology and was used as a surrogate to induce major liver regeneration of the liver. But I think if you look at now what we have with a combination of hepatic vein embolization and portal vein embolization, we have good result. And the procedure, again, not only portal vein embolization, but the hepatic vein embolization is done in radiology safely as well. It's done differently from the portal vein embolization because, you know, you have to access the hepatic vein, and instead of accessing the hepatic vein through the liver, as we do with the portal vein embolization, it's accessed through a transjugular approach and directly occluding the hepatic vein, either the right hepatic vein or the middle or both. And then the coils are placed, and these coils are special coils that occlude essentially the hepatic vein. And again, the procedure is done safely.
I just have one question, and maybe this is, you know, as a trainee, when do you decide to occlude the right hepatic vein or the middle hepatic vein or both? What is the thought process behind which vein you choose to occlude in HBE?
I think that's a really good question. And I think that, unfortunately, I don't have a satisfying answer for that because I don't think at this point in time we have data to guide the kinetics of hypertrophy of one versus the other. I'll tell you my personal practice. This is something that I have offered to multiple patients, is I start with the right hepatic vein. Typically because, as we mentioned, these are patients who are most often undergoing at least a right hepatectomy, if not an extended right hepatectomy, and I feel it allows for protection of segment 4 or some of segment 4 if you're planning on leaving some of that, if you leave the middle hepatic vein drainage open. So it just kind of keeps your options open. So I start from the right and move towards the middle. But typically, if we either do it simultaneously, it's typically right PVE with right hepatic vein embolization, or right PVE plus 4 with right hepatic vein embolization.
Well, that's a great summary on sequential HVE after PVE. And Dr. Bhutta, I'm glad you alluded to this earlier, but the combination of HVE and PVE, and I think it's a good transition into our next article, which is to discuss simultaneous portal and hepatic venous embolization. And we use an article published in 2020 from our French colleagues on radiological simultaneous portal hepatic venous embolization, which is often abbreviated as RASPE or RASP. And so, like we said, it's different from HVE, as we just described, because in RASP, the hepatic veins and the portal veins are embolized in one procedure together, hence the S standing for simultaneous. And so, just some background on this article. Since 2016, the practice at the Authors of Center in France has been that all patients with an FLR less than 25% undergo RASP prior to major hepatectomy, while those with the FLR greater than 25% requiring hypertrophy would undergo a PVE prior to major hepatectomy. And this study is a retrospective review of 73 patients total treated at that center between 2016 and 2018. 37 patients underwent RASP due to the FLR below 25% at baseline, while 36 underwent PVE as they had the FLR greater than 25%. And these groups were matched based on patient demographics, tumor characteristics, and the amount of preoperative chemotherapy they received in terms of the number of cycles. And the increase in FLR volume at 4 weeks was twice as large in the RAS group compared to the PVE group. And additionally, post-op liver failure did not occur in any of the RAS patients, but was seen in 23.3% of the PVE patients. And these are pretty remarkable findings for a trainee like me, considering PVE has been the standard of care in liver hypertrophy for 30 years. But Dr. Nuick, what do you make of this study and the findings behind it?
So I think let's take a step back and then think about why the authors have adopted this this practice and why they published this paper is critical. If some patients get PVE and don't grow enough, but we have something that can be done safely, as we mentioned with the last paper, to add potential hypertrophy for some patients, if you can do it safely, why wouldn't you do simultaneous for everyone up front, right? And that's sort of, I think, the overarching question here from this group. If it can be done safely, and that's what they are trying to establish here, why not offer it for everyone? So in this group, they essentially showed that they have they're very good at what they do. 100% technical success rate in both groups. So they can already do it technically successfully. So it's not going to hurt from a technical standpoint, right? And then they measured that in this, using this procedure, that they used the term profound, more profound growth if they did simultaneous embolization of both the hepatic venous system and the portal vein for these patients. I think it really boils down to what your target is, right? If you want to get just to a certain number to establish that liver growth is safe and above a certain threshold, then you may not necessarily need to do it at the same time for everybody because the liver is going to continue to grow postoperatively. It's not necessarily that you want to grow to your final level before you go to surgery, right? So do you need to expose patients to potentially more risk if you can't offer interventional radiology expertise that to the level of this group, right? Number one. And then number two, I think it has to do, as I said, with not knocking a patient off their treatment path, so to speak. So I don't necessarily want to have a patient undergo both procedures and necessarily potentially forego surgery. Didn't happen in this paper, but you can imagine where that situation would occur. In my experience so far, they're not an equivalence in terms of the experience of the patient. I think that patients do go through a lot more with a simultaneous embolization here. And I think that there's, if you don't need the profound growth, so to speak, we don't necessarily need to offer it for all patients. So I think a selective approach based on what indices you want to get a patient to in order to go to the operating room safely is the critical conclusion.
I may add that... you have to look also at the quality of your portal vein embolization. At many centers, the portal vein embolization is performed very quickly with placement of absorbable material and coiling of the distal branches, anterior and posterior branches of the portal vein, and the portal vein embolization is somewhat inadequate. So I think many centers have resorted to simultaneous portal vein embolization and hepatic vein embolization because the first procedure was insufficient. So I think this is a very important point to note. And as Dr. Newhook just mentioned, in fact, in our experience with high-quality portal vein embolization upfront, when we do a hepatic vein embolization, there might be side effects in terms of elevation of the liver function test and right upper quadrant pain, which we wouldn't have with a portal vein embolization only. The other point also is the article that you just summarized, Dr. Jane, does not really refer to the kinetic growth rate. And we are emphasizing the kinetic growth rate as the ultimate measurement for us of the adequacy of the regeneration before liver resection. So I would say if a patient has a future liver remnant of 20% before procedures, and we do with a portal vein embolization, we go from 20 to 28%. We don't need to have 30%, and we don't feel like the 20% is too small or so small that you should do combined procedures. So we are happy because if you regenerate 8% in 3 weeks, it's more than 2% per week. And in our experience, more than 2% per week is associated with a great outcome. So, and we have in the past done resection in patients who went from 15% to 25% safely because the great KGR, the KGR is the kinetic growth rate, speed of regeneration, and that's the only really good functional measurement we have now for liver regeneration, and that has been shown to be associated with outcomes. So we use that primarily, so we don't feel like necessarily achieving a set volume is the ultimate endpoint for predicting outcome.
I'd like this to emphasize from a different perspective for the listeners what Dr. Bote just mentioned. Summarize in my mind as a one-time trainee and a mentee of Dr. Bote, what he's telling me is that the jury is still out. We don't have data to necessarily say that all patients need to undergo simultaneous HVE and PVE, particularly because we do not know if HVE is necessarily safe or contributes much more if patients undergo high-quality PVE. So you have to interpret all these things, and it's not an insult to the group that's writing this paper. Obviously, there's institutional experience that goes into all of this. So again, our approach is a selective approach here, number one. Number two, I want to editorialize a little bit on the KGR because it's a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, because that is the most important number after any embolization procedure. But again, keep in mind that the KGR is a statistical analysis of hypertrophy after PVE alone, right PVE alone. So again, in the literature and in conversation, a lot of people use the term KGR and apply it in so many different arenas with regards to hypertrophy of the liver that it's not necessarily even appropriate. So actually, we don't know what the KGR that is appropriate to target after simultaneous HVE and PVE really is, because we haven't gotten enough patients in a series to determine where on the kinetic growth rate curve is appropriate to prevent liver insufficiency. So again, it's almost misapplied when we say that the KGR is superior for something like ALPS compared to two-stage hepatectomy, because the KGR 2% per week doesn't mean anything in an ALPS procedure compared to PVE.
Yeah, that's a great point. Those are great points. I think for all the listeners, especially the trainees, it's important to remember that KGR is an important, and if not the king, when it comes to measuring the adequacy of your PVE. And when you read a lot of studies about venous deprivation and liver hypertrophy, one of the big questions you should be asking, which we're asking, is what is the KGR?
We don't know. I mean, we just don't know what the quality of hypertrophy is after such profound growth, right?
Right.
To kind of put it very plainly, we don't know if all the hookups are working the way they should. Is a 10 times rapid hypertrophy a healthy hypertrophy? We don't know.
Is that always all that extra parenchyma actually functional? That's key. All right. And so It's a great, great discussion there. And so we're going to switch gears a little and move into the final part of our episode and discuss the fast-track two-stage hepatectomy. And just to give some context for the listeners, generally in patients with bilateral colorectal liver mets who are at risk for post-op liver failure due to the extent of the resection, they need an insufficient FLR, we do a two-stage hepatectomy with PVE. Basically, you do your first-stage hepatectomy, give the patient some time to recover, perform the PVE. The patient needs to recover after that and have time for the liver to hypertrophy. And then we perform our second-stage hepatectomy to remove the remaining liver lesions. But as you can see, there's a lot of time in between the two stages. At best, case series report a median time of 7 to 8 weeks, but in some patients, this can last months. And unfortunately, 20% of patients who undergo that first-stage resection don't proceed to the second-stage hepatectomy because they have insufficient liver hypertrophy after the PVE or disease progression during that time interval I mentioned between the stages. And so in order to minimize that time interval, we proposed a fast-track two-stage hepatectomy in which patients would undergo their first-stage hepatectomy and PVE together in the same setting using a hybrid IR surgical suite. And so from our institution, we have a prospective study that was published in 2021, which included 19 patients with bilateral colorectal liver mets scheduled for a fast-track two-stage hepatectomy. The median number of lesions was 10, and the median size of the largest tumor prior to surgery was 2.4 centimeters. 17 of these patients, or 89%, completed the first-stage hepatectomy in PVE, and none of them actually had major complications from this novel combined procedure. The two patients that did not get the PVE was one due to portal venous hypertension, and the other had disseminated peritoneal disease throughout. Now, 12 of the patients proceeded to second-stage hepatectomy, as unfortunately 5 suffered disease progression in the time interval between stages, but I should note that this median interval between stages is only 5.6 weeks, which is a huge improvement off the 7 to 8 weeks I mentioned earlier, and it's likely that these patients just had far worse disease biology. And it should also be noted that inadequate hypertrophy or FLR was not the reason for completing second-stage hepatectomy in any of the patients who ultimately completed the combined first-stage hepatectomy with PVE. Rather, it was generally disease progression or severe liver injury from cytotoxic chemotherapy. And so there are definitely a ton of benefits to this fast-track two-stage hepatectomy, such as reducing anesthesia and operative encounters for the patient since the first-stage hepatectomy and PVE are combined. And the time of interval of only 5 to 6 weeks between stages is a huge improvement over that 7 to 8 weeks with a traditional two-stage hepatectomy. But Dr. Gauthier, Dr. Nuke, what are your thoughts on this novel approach?
This is such in the wheelhouse of Dr. Vote, so I'll let him go.
So I think you gave a good summary of this paper. I should add that these patients had a median of 10 metastases. So two-stage hepatectomy is really performed at the institution for patients who cannot undergo parenchymal-sparing surgery where we resect individual metastases. And for this small select group of patients, we still feel surgery is a reasonable approach. We propose surgery. And when we consider two-stage hepatectomy, it's something that the patient has to buy into. And emotionally also, you are now embarking on, looking at two surgery, then a portal vein embolization in between. The idea behind the fast track was that, as you mentioned, we wanted to reduce the interval between the first stage and the two stage because some papers have shown 3 months, 4 months, up to 6 months after between the two procedures, have combined also these sequences with chemotherapy, and we didn't want to give too much chemotherapy. In fact, in our experience, we have not historically given chemotherapy between the first and the second stage. So we were fortunate at our institution to have a hybrid room available to redesign this three-procedure sequence. And we have this hybrid room, which has a CT on rail, a fluoroscopy availability, so that you can do a CAT scan, you can do the portal vein embolization, And you can do the procedure, also the surgery. It's a carbon fiber table. It's somewhat cumbersome for surgeons because it doesn't move and tilt as we would like to. But we have used it for the first stage procedure. It was fairly easy because the first stage procedure is an easy procedure. So what we do in a hybrid room, essentially, we replicate what we used to do as two procedures. So we do the first stage hepatectomy, and then in the same setting, the patient stays in the room and percutaneously, transhepatically, with the same ipsilateral approach we have used, we do the portal vein embolization. And then we do a CT on rail. So in fact, it's three encounters in one. It's two procedures and three encounters in one. The patient gets also the post-portal vein embolization CT. So we can do the volumetry based on this CT in anticipation of the volumetry we do 3 weeks later, and we're going to be able to do the two measurements. So as you said, 4 weeks later, on average, we were performing the second procedure. And again, the stumbling block is really the fact that these patients have advanced disease, and a number of these patients did not undergo the second stage, but it was because of progression of disease and not lack of regeneration. So again, hybrid room, it's sort of the Ferrari now, but it's in the early stage of its development. I think we're looking here at MD Anderson as having a better design hybrid room for surgery. I think there are a lot of advantages in having our interventional radiology with us in surgery, and CT is a great imaging and better than ultrasound for some imaging, and I'd like to have it in the future with advanced suites, and more development will be needed to perfect this hybrid approach and fast-track approach.
Yeah, definitely. I think it could be something big for the future, as you alluded to, Dr. Vogtay, because I know big criticism of two-stage hepatectomy with PV is that long interval, especially in the people who are of the ALPS camp, because they claim, well, ALPS gives you regeneration so quickly, but obviously ALPS is just so morbid. So I think, like you said, this having this fast-track two-stage hepatectomy in the hybrid suite, the Ferrari of the future, I think that it's very helpful in reducing that time frame. And unfortunately, you know, tumor biology and disease biology is something you have to consider. There are just some patients who, even in such a short window as we had, that 4 to 6 weeks, will still progress. But overall, I think this was a great discussion. I think the big takeaways for everyone is that there's a lot of factors that go into surgical resection for liver tumors, patient characteristics, tumor biology, and ensuring adequate future liver remnant to prevent post-hepatic insufficiency. And we hope this episode gives all the listeners a solid understanding of PVE as well as future advances in liver venous deprivation therapy to help induce adequate hypertrophy of FLR. And, you know, we'll see you next time. And as always, dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.